Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
And I'm Jen Tellick. Hey, everybody.
We've been MIA for 2 weeks because in the past 2 weeks a serious hit has been dealt onto our food and beverage industry here in New York City. Unfortunately, episode 50 has to be episode Sandy. I can't ignore it.
She was here. She was a big girl and she was naughty. She was not very nice.
I always associated the name Sandy with Grease, and I always had a crush on her. And remember that song
who
that's like,
didn't?
Oh, Sandy.
Are you kidding
baby.
Me? Those leather pants? And then they gave her like the sort of half perm that was put over to the side. And that was the only time she ever rocked that haircut. I always resented the fact that she went back to the sort of, you know, puritanical like bob.
Yeah, when she got sexy, that was the best part of the movie. Anyway, I hope one day we can think about Sandy in that way and not in the storm way. In studio, though, we have several people from our industry who were affected in many different ways. Really honored to have Mark Snyder and Darren Palos from Red Hook Winery. Red Hook, one of the hardest hit neighborhoods in our borough, in the borough of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And they had water on three sides of their winery, so you can only imagine what's happened. We're going to check in with them about their next steps. Also in studio, Elizabeth Chubbuck, Associate Director of Wholesale for Murray's Cheese. We're going to talk to her about how they dealt with the power outage in Lower Manhattan, their big scramble to save all the cheese. And I actually saw her the day after the storm, kind of running around with like headlamps and generators. And so we'll talk to her, check in. Did they save everything? We don't know yet. Also in studio, Frank Winter.
Winters.
Sure doesn't feel like winter today. 63 degrees. He is a server, but more importantly, a playwright. So we'll check in with him if he was impacted, because I know a lot of servers lost hours, lost wages because they either couldn't get to work or their work was out of power.
Speaking of which, have you heard about Dine Down, Tip Up?
Mm-mm.
This was a thing. Anthony Bourdain started a little Twitter movement, which became a big movement in general in social media, called Dine Down, Tip Up, which was meant to be a catchphrase that people were supposed to tweet and talk about, hashtag, etc., which was encouraging people to dine downtown and tip more than they usually would to just sort of reinvigorate that industry. I know we're going to talk more about this later, but I work in the West Village myself. Mm-hmm. We didn't get it as bad, but one of my best friends works at Fort Defiance and Red Hook, and I certainly know that so many people, not just downtown Manhattan, obviously so many parts of Brooklyn, our beloved borough, were hit so hard, and so many people we love are struggling to get their places up and running again. And this is one way. So many of my friends and family who aren't in New York have said, I know you're okay. I know your house is okay, and we're so happy, but are you okay financially? And I mm-hmm. say, of course it was rough. You know, I'm so happy that I'm safe and I have my place, but this was a small way to at least, I think, fiscally sort of promote even just morale, you know, like go out, support these businesses. If you have the money to spend it. And if you have the morale to lend it. And,
mm-hmm. Because I know so many people were, I live in Alphabet City. So I was walking over the Williamsburg Bridge, kind of putting all my money over there. And I know they were, I'm sure many parts of Brooklyn had just record sales because they were the only people who could serve food.
Right.
And so, yeah, I do. Let's call on those people to come over to Lower Manhattan and spend the money.
Yeah. And I mean,
bring it back.
I know there's still an ongoing volunteer effort specifically in Red Hook. I know it's happening in the Rockaways as well, but I feel like of all of the friends I've had so far who volunteered, those are the two areas where the most people were going. And I it goes without saying that we here would love to encourage any of you who are listening to do that, because so many of us were fortunate and that we do still have a job and we do still have a house, but that is obviously not the case. So I would implore you to, there are so many options, through the bigger guys, obviously the Red Cross, et cetera, but also there are smaller outfits that are happening in both of those neighborhoods. So I would encourage any of you on a somber note to look into that this week.
Preach on.
Yeah, girl.
Frank, how you doing?
Me? Phenomenal. I've got my S back in my last name. That's exciting. I was actually just very, you were talking about that. I just did this weird, I just went to like a shelter thing with my theater company. And it was great, you know, because we're like a puppet theater company for the most part, and we occasionally do other things. But we mostly work with puppets, and so we went we went to this school that had been turned into like a shelter, a makeshift shelter, and we were doing this puppet show, but they'd also scheduled this old folk singer who, like, clearly was bummed that Occupy wasn't, like, you know, he didn't have like a bunch of Occupy signs, but like clearly didn't have anywhere to be at that moment. And so we were, like, singing old Union songs, dancing with mermaid puppets all day. And people were really, really getting into it. So I guess the moral of the story is, even things that don't seem helpful, I guess, can be helpful. Like having a mermaid puppet.
Or puppets. Sorry.
No. Incredibly unhelpful thing in terms of
hurricanes. I dare you to tell me an instance where a puppet would not be helpful.
Well, okay, the Muppets, I mean, they're always helpful.
Incredibly helpful. In disaster relief, specifically.
Speaking of Yule Theater Company. So for those of you listening today, this is Frank Winters. He's a good friend of mine, and I'm blessed to say a collaborator, and an incredibly gifted playwright. In fact, his new play, On the Head of a Pin, just had its world premiere here in New York a couple of weeks ago. Unfortunately, you guys lost your last couple of performances because of the hurricane.
Because of Sandra Dee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was terrible.
I was glad I got to squeeze in there and see it before. It was a remarkable play, and it seems that it's moving forward, and we'll all have the chance to see it again in a bigger theater very soon, which is great.
Hey. I have nothing to report on that front.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Because it's actually... We'll shift slightly to something just as somber but different, and the play deals with does it deal with?
Well,
tell us, Frank.
Listen, if you guys like hurricanes, I bet you also like torture. Dear Lord, no. The play was my response to watching this great documentary called Iraq for Sale: The War Profiteers, and it's about what Halliburton and Blackwater and Khaki and Titan. These are all military contractors. Yeah, what they were all up to while we were focused on other things during the war. And, you know, there's a lot of money made. There's a lot of money made during the war by these corporations who turned, you know, essentially basic, like, catering and laundry responsibilities into, you know, could they get their little private armies in there? And one of the things that happened at places like Abu Ghraib is that the lines of communication got blurred as to who was in charge. Was it the U.S. military and its soldiers who are subject to the, you know, code of the military uniform code of justice, and therefore they could be, you know, court-martialed, or was it the, you know, representatives of Khaki and Titan, who were often the same soldiers who were just getting paid more, often entire zeros more, to do similar jobs with less responsibility and, of course, less accountability. The play, which I'm eventually getting to, is about somebody who finds himself in that situation, somebody who... without any military experience, found themselves in a position to do some real harm, like at Abu Ghraib prison.
Like I said, I saw it.
The play was almost as long as that conversation.
It was about a young woman, specifically. That was it, ladies and gentlemen. On the Head of a Pen by Frank Winters. It's beautiful because it's sort of two stories. Correct me if I'm wrong. That are sort of juxtaposed. There's the one narrative about this young woman who's an interpreter. She studied languages she's studying linguistics, and she thinks she's being hired to be an interpreter, a translator in Iraq. And when she goes over, she finds out that her job description is much more intense than that. And she finds herself interrogating, being forced to interrogate prisoners in a violent and aggressive manner.
Which was something that happened a lot over there.
And then the other half is follows a journalist who's trying to reveal and unmask this. But I wanted to talk to you specifically today about we were joking a little bit before at the bar. Frank said he wrote half the play on receipt paper when he was a barista. And
where were you a barista?
Well, I don't write there anymore. there's a little cafe restaurant by Lincoln Center called Indie Food and Wine. Lovely, lovely little cafe restaurant. And I know there are a couple of people here who work in restaurants, and I apologize because I am a blight to your industry. I'm like exactly the New York actor writer you don't want to hire, because like I would take the receipt paper.
That stuff's expensive.
I know.
Says the GM.
This is what I'm saying. And I would zhug it out, and then I'd roll into a little scroll, and I'd go to the bathroom, and or just when I was there, and I like wrote like entire scenes of my play in between cappuccinos. And
it's amazing you were inspired by coffee to write about.
I was inspired in spite of coffee.
Ah, okay.
I've worked as a barista for so much of my life, I can't stand the smell of it. Actually, it's like Clockwork Orange. Like it ruined by association. The smell of coffee just smells like 5 a.m.
I work at a Scottish restaurant, so that's how I feel about turnips and potatoes.
Not Scotch, though.
No,
I'm just fine with that.
Okay.
Anyway, I also wanted to talk. So Frank and I have been working on a project together, which I'm excited about, and it is political also, but hopefully funnier.
And shorter.
Puppets?
And in fact, one of the first times I was ever on the show, Miss Kiefer, was as a guest many moons ago. And Frank and I were then doing a fundraiser for that film.
Mm-hmm.
And we're about to finish shooting it. So it's all coming full circle.
Amazing.
We talked about Kiva.org.
We did talk about Kiva.org.
Last time, which you should still go to.
Yeah. Speaking of .org, as a quick segue, I wanted to mention as well, we were talking before about Dine Down, Tip Up. There's also, for any of you listening who do work in our industry, who do work in the food and beverage industry, and are currently out of work or were out of work for a time due to the hurricane, there are a couple of avenues that people emailed me about this week where you can be compensated. There's one that is called modestneeds.org, and they've set up a specific package for New York restaurant workers who have either lost literal work time or have just been hit financially and lost money. They've set up a grant program, which is really
awesome. Amazing.
Yeah. And also, I didn't realize, some people in my work were talking about this, but the Department of Labor set up a disaster relief package for people
who are unemployed because of the storm?
Who are unemployed and specifically who are unsalaried. So tip workers, mm-hmm. for tip workers. Again, this is, you know, but a small concern in this terrible thing that happened. But it was a small positive light, I think, for a lot of people in our industry that were out of work and nobody knew what to do.
I feel like everyone felt very divided because there were people who were not at all affected. There were people who were only affected because they couldn't get to work.
Yeah.
Or then there were people who were in the areas where there was no power. And then, of course, there are the people who are devastated and lost their home, lost their business. So,
with Jesse, actually, my girlfriend and I were very happy we got to hang out with Jesse.
No, Jen was the savior. She gave us a warm place to stay and food.
Wanted to bring it up because we drove in. Yeah. This was before the sort of traffic martial law wasn't stated about how many people were allowed in the car to drive over the bridge. But we have a Zipcar account, and Lindsay had said, let's get in the car, let's go get Jesse and Aaron, let's pick them up, and let's take them back to Bushwick. So we drove in, and it was the first time we, as spoiled little Bushwickians, we had power. We were, which is the only time I've ever been able to say that. We drove in, it was the first time we'd seen downtown, and what a bizarre Children of Men sight it was.
It was apocalyptic at night. It
Elizabeth
was dark.
Elizabeth Chubbuck on the mic.
Hey, guys. By 6 p.m., it was pitch black. Pitch black on the streets. You couldn't see anything. Looking out the windows, the city was completely still. I live down on Sullivan Street in Soho, South Greenwich Village. And I mean, it was spooky. It was spooky. You wanted to be indoors by 6 o'clock.
We didn't know what to do, and we were driving, and Jesse and Aaron had obviously been there for a couple of days, and they had already become experts on the no electricity driving. They were like, nope, just wait, let the pedestrian go. Okay, now you can drive. And yeah, it was a strange time, but I suppose my point is, like you said, Jesse, it was amazing, as New Yorkers always do in a time of crisis. People did pull together in such an awesome way.
I just want to give a shout out to the traffic cops who stood out there in the middle of pitch black intersections with just a few flares lined up, directing traffic at night, because they weren't there for the first couple of nights. I think it was probably maybe the third night that they got out there, and what a difference it made for feeling safe as a passenger or a driver moving through those areas. But I got to hand it to them. They have courage.
Thank you for saying that, because I feel like that's probably something people hadn't considered. Of course, there were all the photos circulating about people like, oh, you can charge your phone here. I have electricity. Come charge your phone. And those were all the sort of like kitschy things that people latched onto. But that's awesome.
I think some of the other things that didn't get attention about Manhattan, a lot of like the bigger housing projects and housing situations down on the Lower East Side, some of them lost water for 24 hours, completely lost water. I shared a taxi to like East Midtown one morning with a man who lives down in the Lower East Side, works a construction job uptown, and he said that after 12 hours of no water, he just went down to the street and cranked open a fire hydrant.
That's amazing.
And the water started pouring out, and he said people were lined up down the block with buckets because they had nothing.
And it's so interesting, I feel, media-wise. Well, for one thing, with a power outage like this, so many people didn't have access to media, so we were all so divided as to who knew what was happening when, who was getting power when, who was okay. I mean, we have friends in the Rockaways. We didn't know if they were even okay, like, let alone if they had internet. And so everybody was so – it was also disjointed that I feel like there were these little pocket instances like that. People didn't even know.
And I think even now there is, I tried to go volunteer yesterday morning, and we were going to head out to the Rockaways. And by the time we got on the road, the traffic was so bad that the day would have been three quarters over by the time we made it out there. I think everyone is, there's a lot of attention right now being paid on the Rockaways because they certainly suffered pretty devastating destruction. Staten Island is another place that needs help. And now that the ferry is back up and running, I think it's pretty easy, as long as you can get to get downtown, you can hop on the ferry, head across, and, There are a lot of people who lost a lot there as well.
So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to Mark and Darren from Red Hook Winery about what they lost and about how they're going to pick it back up. Morning After.
You're listening to Andy's Biscuits by Pamela Royal on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
We're back on the morning after in studio with Mark Snyder and Darren Palace of Red Hook Winery. I mean, I can't even tell the story like you guys can. So, I mean, I guess to just start it out, I want to know, you know, first off, how you prepared the winery for the storm and what you expected, and then what you came back to.
Well, first, thanks for having us. It's awesome.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
We prepared pretty well, I thought. We took everything off the floor. We spent 3 days lifting things, securing fermentations. We brought in our last grapes on Saturday before the storm. And then we sandbagged the outside pretty, you know, pretty thoroughly.
How high did you sandbag?
About 3 feet. Last year in Irene, we there was no water at all. It didn't even come on the pier. 499, the which goes out on the pier next to Fairway, mm-hmm. they were flooded. Mm-hmm. And Irene, so we thought we'd be in relatively good shape, and we thought, hey, the water come up maybe a foot. But surprise.
How high did it actually come?
In the winery is about 5.5 feet.
Oh my God!
And I think Red Hook. I've heard a lot of different reports, but they're talking about a 16-foot surge. And we're right on the pier. I think the issue for us is it was basically a raging ocean inside of the winery. Mm. You know, we would have been prepared if water came in. I mean, 5.5 feet would have been pretty devastating regardless. But the water came in not in a calm fashion, but really in like an ocean fashion. We had giant multi-thousand pound planters from our pier and even the other pier that came through the overhead door, the two sets of doors, and just knocked everything in. Things were just kind of ransacked. But in general, I mean, I'd say looking back on this, if I could kind of look ahead, I think it's the worst of times and the best of times in a certain way, because the community's been pretty freaking awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, there's been 40 people a day at the winery helping us clean up. People we've never met, you know.
Yeah. Which you were talking about, the groups, the Red Hook Initiative, which we have much love for.
Can we? I mean, I'm speaking personally, and also anyone who's listening. How can we come help if we haven't been there yet?
That's a good question. We've still, I don't want to say holding pattern. I mean, we're there every day and doing what needs to be done. But there might be in the future, you know, there's just still some hurdles we need to do now before we really know and put people to work. And it's such a humbling thing for us. I mean, we got there, you know, obviously Tuesday morning at like 6 a.m. after the storm. And, you know, it's like everything's gone. Everything's on the floor. And then we took 2 days of really documenting all the damage, like taking photos of everything we could. We didn't really know where to start. So, and then people started just coming.
Yeah.
And again, it's humbling when you have someone literally shoveling shit and sewage and other things and diesel fuel and things like that. And then someone comes and is volunteering to feed the volunteers who are helping you. It's just like it totally opens you up to a whole nother chapter, at least in my life.
Now, in a winery, I don't think everyone understands all of the elements that actually exist within it. Obviously, we're not speaking of vines, but we're speaking of the grapes. I mean, harvest just happened in September or October. And so you guys had grapes fermenting in tank. You had wine in barrel. Just kind of let us know the kind of things that you have in your winery and you know, why this is such a big hit.
Well, for us, I mean, in terms of the wine, you've got wine products. So there's 3 stages. There's bottled wine, finished wine, which luckily, and we can get into this at some point, we had bottled wines, a good portion of them, off-site. So we probably had 2/3 of our wines up to now off-site. Then the aging stage, which is wine in barrels, I would say between 60 and 80% of that wine is gone. So that's comprises 3 vintages. And then...
Was that like what, 2008, 2009, 2010?
9, 10, 11.
9, 10, 11.
So we had some 09 wines. We had the majority of the 10 wines, and I think all of the 11 wines except for the Riesling that we bottled.
Some white and another Chardonnay
that we bottled. And then, so that wine was compromised, and that's a combination of the water just came in. When we finally were able to get into the space, you know, we have both sides, the first thing I saw was... the barrel rails, which were in the barrel room, and they were in the front of the winery, which I you know, there were 200 barrels on it. So the barrels had been lifted out, dumped out. Half of them were filled with salt water. Half of them were broken on the floor. And so it was just a complete mess, a jumble of barrels and stuff. And then out kind of the third stage is harvest. And anything during harvest, our current harvest, 2012, which was in tank, in theory, would be saved. Mm-hmm. All of the puncheons were compromised. All of the bins, including Darren's Syrah that he was so proud of, was gone. It was we tasted it. It was red, but it was salty red. So all of the bins and puncheons and things like that were gone. And then whatever was in tank, we had a shot of trying to save, but we've had no power. Actually, since before the storm on Sunday, the power went out. So we've had no ability to pump over, to control temperature, anything like that. So those three stages of wines have been just completely obliterated. In addition, then we've got the space. So the tasting room's gone. Yeah. Everything was destroyed, all the equipment. And then
you had a full kitchen in there.
Yeah.
Full, beautiful kitchen.
Full, the wine refrigerators, we had three of those. So the tasting room section is gone. And then we have to start ripping out the walls and everything now. And then on the winery side, all of the equipment is gone. And that's really the big hit is, you know, we got $1 million plus in damage just in equipment and, you know, infrastructure.
And then in addition, you have to pay the farmers who you bought grapes from.
That's a real challenge for us. You know, now we're faced with just crazy decisions. So we've got current vintage and, you know, the grape bills are coming in and, and we're like, okay, well, it's all on the floor or it's going down the drain somehow when we have to dispose of it. So we can't not pay our, you know, those are our partners in this whole project and they're all local, local growers. So we're really faced with difficult, you know, options ahead. I mean, we can pay them, but obviously that'll just put us out of business. We're in a holding pattern waiting for insurance and that whole complicated web of,
yeah, and our growers are, you know, what we do with the wine we make is to show a sense of place out there and what can really be done out there. And I said Red Hook Winery, we've always considered our North Fork friends and, you know, people we work with, like partners. So we don't obviously want to not pay them because we want to get fruit from them again because we want to keep making wine here.
So, where can people buy wine from you guys? And I heard someone pretty special bought some wine from you today.
Yeah, so we were at the pier today, and the mayor came down.
And I have pretty cool.
Yeah, well, we offered it to him for free, and he, as a gentleman, ensured that he wanted to pay for it, so and gave a sales tax also.
That's really poetic.
No, it's a great showing of the community. It's been amazing everyone, including Jesse and the whole team there. It's just been difficult to really express our gratitude. So luckily, we can still sell wine wholesale, and that's huge for us because that solves a short-term issue, like of just creating some cash flow so that all the employees continue to get paid and that we can start the cleanup process before anything else kicks in. Longer term, we'll have other issues. So what we've done is we've thought long and hard about sustainability, and we've decided to not accept donations because that donation pool, in my mind, is a fixed pool, and there are people that need those funds today to survive, to get to tomorrow. Mm-hmm. A restaurant or a, you know, Mile End Barbecue or Steve's Key Lime, these guys need cash today so that they can rebuild their business and continue. And if they don't have any way to, you know, they have to buy equipment and food, and then they're kind of back in business in a sense. Mm-hmm. It's a big challenge, but that's today's cash. We, fortunately, have bottled wines. Mm-hmm. So we can generate today's cash without donations, and that's been a difficult decision because I see a lot of donations going everywhere. So we don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot in a sense, but I feel like the sustainability of the other businesses is more crucial because if a restaurant buys wine from us, we don't want all of the proceeds to go back to Red Hook Winery. We want them to be able to sell the wines and make profit on them, and then it causes their sustainability and the exposure of Red Hook at the same time. So right now we're continuing wholesale, and we've set up a mock makeshift web page where we're putting packs together where people can buy wines, which is great.
And what's that web page?
RedHookWinery.com. Okay. It's pretty basic.
Yeah, we just
that's all you need.
Kind of shut down the website, which we were going to launch in the next few weeks. Mm-hmm. We've had the web page, but we put this up there now. There'll be more stuff coming up as we go along. It's kind of, you know, just sewn together a little bit, but
And we transferred the telephone number to Sandra's cell phone so people could actually kind of call, and we'll cobble
and
together.
And it was her birthday
things.
Yesterday, so you can wish her happy birthday.
Happy birthday,
and
Ben. And Ben. Yes, and what other restaurants you can people can go and buy your wine? Because by buying your wine at restaurants, that means that the restaurant can order more of your wine.
Well, obviously, Terroir is pouring wines by the glass. At Guild, all of their Del restaurants. Frisco. There's
the North Restaurant North upstate in Armonk.
DBGB.
DBGB's has some by the glass.
St. Anselm has
St. Anselm.
Wine.
Yeah. Parm. Parm Restaurant. Teresi. They're pouring it by the glass also. I know there's a lot of all their amazing people. I'm just trying to rack my brain right now.
That's already an awesome lineup of restaurants. So please, people, check it out.
Blue Hill.
Yeah, and if you're local, St. Anselm is a fabulous restaurant, and I've had your wine at St. Anselm. Awesome. It's awesome. Great.
And just before we go to break, I do also want to point on this that Mark, you helped organize or work on the Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen, Bon Jovi like benefit concert.
Yeah, which, it was pretty awesome.
Which I didn't mention because when Billy came on and he was talking about Brooklyn, and then Mark Rivera looked right at you.
Yeah, he pointed.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's really good.
Billy jumped right in, and Bruce did as well. And you know, we always make fun of the New York, New Jersey thing, but I feel like this is the first time Darren and I are in complete solidarity.
Yeah.
Darren Chris being Christie. From New Jersey and Mark being from New York.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I just think it's amazing that you... Even though you're going through so much, you were organizing something else, organizing that concert for other people. Guys, it's been great to have you in studio, and
thank you very much.
I wish you the best
everything.
Of luck, and I will continue to support you as long as I can.
Thank
you so much. RedHookWinery.com.
Yes.
Once again.
All right.
Go there, buy the wine.
Awesome.
We'll be back on the morning after with Elizabeth Chubbuck. Talk to her about cheese.
You're listening to This Body by Pamela Royal on the heritageradionetwork.org. .org.
We're back on the morning after in studio with Elizabeth Chubbuck, Associate Director of Wholesale for Murray's Cheese. And like I was saying earlier, I ran into you the day after the storm. And, you know, basically I ran to Terroir Tribeca because we're just steps away from the Hudson. I didn't know if we were going to get water. Luckily, we were fine. Just power was out. And we also stopped by Murray's Cheese just to make sure everything was okay with you and everything was okay there. And I... can only imagine the impact a power outage has on a cheese shop.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to say that we were blessed in that we didn't take any water on. There was no flooding in the store whatsoever. But obviously, cheese is a perishable product. Some cheeses more so than others. And when the power goes out, there is a short window of time in which our caves and our walk-ins and things are going to hold temperature and allow us to preserve our product. So it was... a pretty monumental scramble by about 7 or 8 of us on Tuesday to actually carry all the cheese out of the shop, load it onto pallets, build the pallets, wrap them in plastic, figure out where we were going to get them, where we were going to take them to, find a place that could store them in refrigeration, and then actually getting them there.
And so... When I saw you, you were like, we're doing triage. So that's what you mean by triage?
Well,
that sounds like an emergency room kind of thing.
Well, triage in different ways. I mean, getting the fresh and highly perishable cheeses out of the shop and into refrigeration was definitely a race against the clock. We also store most of our cheese in the basement. So with the elevator out, it was about 6 of us, carrying by hand probably close to 1,000 pounds of cheese out the door. But when I was actually cheese triage, I'm really talking more about continuing to care for the cheeses as they live in the caves and continue to age. So, you know, cheese is a controlled spoilage of milk. So you're taking a highly perishable product, using that decomposition, controlling it in order to create something delicious and good. But once you have that cheese created, you sort of launch it into another stage of controlled spoilage, if you will, or it's not really the best way to say it, but affinage is the word they use in France. It refers to refinement or the aging and caring for of cheeses. So, you know, we have four aging facilities, four caves downstairs below the shop on Bleecker Street, where we are continuously aging cheeses. Some of them, cheeses like Gruyere, Parmigiano Reggiano, you know, 80-pound wheels of low-moisture cheeses, they're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. They don't need much attention.
They probably came to perfect temperature.
Oh, they were perfect. They enjoyed it. You know, not much. The environment in those caves really didn't change at all. The temperature held, and those cheeses were fine. But the smaller format, higher moisture, softer goat's milk cheeses, things from the Loire Valley, things that are domestic that we bring in green meaning fresh, unripened, and that we ripen in-house, the cave-aged cheeses, you know, just because the lights are out doesn't mean they don't need attention. So there were about four of us down in the cave where all of our, as we call the little baby goat cheeses, are housed on Tuesday afternoon, flipping and padding and plucking different molds from the surface of these cheeses, you know, with one hanging bulb that was affixed to a generator, you know, on the 25 meter cord that kept continuously going out. So we had like one flashlight. So as soon as the light went out, everyone would stop working. We'd fumble around, get the flashlight, turn it back on, and continue with the work, which was
A
lot of work.
Go ahead, Jen.
No, I was just going to ask where you took them, because you were talking about transporting some of them. Where did they end up?
So Larkin Cold Storage is our our customs broker house in Long Island City. And they are at a point in Long Island City where they took on no water and they maintained power throughout the entire storm. And it was, I mean, really everyone who had, every cheese shop in the city who works with Larkin, who had product that was compromised, brought it there by whatever means possible.
Yeah.
And they were able to take it all in?
Oh yeah. Adam Moskowitz is a hell of a guy. And he opened his doors graciously and kept people there late when everyone had to get home, just to make sure that our product was safe. And we are incredibly grateful for that.
I'm imagining, you're using the medical metaphor before of triage. I'm just imagining that ride. I mean, getting them there, obviously this is a time sensitive thing, not in a matter of 2 minutes, but you know, you're dealing with temperature.
Well, so they go in refrigerated vans. So really,
they're in, they're okay.
Exactly.
And were any of your caves compromised?
Nope.
The climate can be recreated once the power comes back on.
Yeah, the climate, you know, it was interesting because we got the cheese, all the cheese out, any of the cheese that might have been compromised, we removed completely. We took it off site. We put it under refrigeration. We stabilized it. And then on Thursday, there were about four of us down in the caves again for 8 hours, again with headlamps, with candles, with flashlights, and we cleaned and sanitized all of the spaces that had been emptied. It was just, I mean, in that way, it was a gift. You know, you try to find what was the good of it. Well, we would never have had a day to get all the cheese out of the shop and really just sort of reset it. And we were given that day. And it was, you know, I scrubbed wooden shelves that weigh probably a third of what I weigh for about 4 hours in the dark. And we sang songs and we were, you know, grateful that our business had survived because with very, very, very little loss, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like the one thing we haven't touched upon is that once all of those restaurants opened back up, because I know my restaurant opened up on Saturday, basically 6:30 a.m. is when the power came back on in Tribeca, then all of those restaurants are like, we need our cheese. And we also have a gas shortage going on.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, how did, like, once everything was back up and running, how did Murray's approach that?
So
did you lose gas?
So our inventory was moved from our shop on Bleecker Street to Long Island City. And then once the power came back on and our compressors were up and running in our own warehouse in Long Island City, we moved it there. And once we had our product there, it took us about a day to get everything in order. And we started making deliveries again on Friday. Friday morning, Friday afternoon, we shipped cheeses out. We did two delivery services on Saturday, where we normally do one. And, you know, people were ready for their product, but they were also incredibly, incredibly understanding and patient. And that was just a really great thing to see people. And, you know, everyone works so hard in this industry, and we're always up against the gun, and we're always tired, and we're always short-staffed. There's always something. But to come back to work and to have people uptown who hadn't lost power, you know, call us, and the first question out of their mouth wasn't necessarily, when can I get my cheese? But it was, how'd you guys make out? Is everyone okay? What's going on down there? Is the product okay? Is the shop okay? Are the caves okay? And that sense of concern for each other's well-being, this very kind of human,
yes,
caring
it's
for people.
It's a complete community. It really is. And I agree with you. Like, I feel like anyone who has emailed me about buying wine or having me buy their wine, they've been like, how are you?
Exactly. First.
And I think that's such a great, it's a great feeling to know that our community is so connected like that, and that everyone cares. I really can't wait to pick up this mood. You know, one of our favorite segments, What's on the Menu at Chardonnay, is we're going to go into that after a break. Chardonnay is our mythical restaurant where all bad food and wine trends are celebrated. And I
or where
cannot
they come to die.
Or where they come to die. I cannot wait to add a cheese list to Chardonnay's. And I know Elizabeth Chubbuck is going to help us with that. And she was incredibly influenced by the 90s.
We have wine and cheese in-house today for Chardonnay's.
This is actually
remarkable.
We have reunited Red Hook Winery and Murray's Cheese, I have to say, on an unfortunately
and
somber
it
note.
It feels so good.
We can take it right back to the 90s.
I cannot wait. Let's all right. On the morning after, taking it back to the 90s. We'll be back.
You're listening to Sweet Talk by Pamela Royal on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we are back the morning after on Heritage Radio Network. We are here to revisit one of our favorite weekly segments, What's on the Menu at Chardonnay's. Our beloved guests, bless their hearts, have been put to the test, and I'm very interested to see what they've got in store for us. I think we should start with cheese.
Yeah. Queso time.
What is on the menu at Chardonnay's?
Well, when we're talking about cheese plates, it's sort of a combination of farmstead romance, a callback to your own sense of nostalgia, and then obviously, you know, the just visual decadence, the textural variation, and of course, flavor. We couldn't get out of it without flavor. So for Chardonnay's, the cheese plate at Chardonnay's is really sort of the 90s, an interpretive dance of the 90s as performed by cheese. And the number one spot on our cheese plate, we're going to go back to one of the pioneers of domestic cheese, Laura Chanel, and we're just going with the most basic here. Laura Chanel's Chevlog, fresh goat cheese at its best, tangy, lemony, bright, velvety, smooth, and pure
so
white.
Exotic.
Yeah.
Unrolled as a whole log at the table.
Absolutely. Unrolled as a whole log, and people are just given butter knives to really cut into it.
And almonds.
And almonds. We might even roll it in crushed almonds.
Okay, now it sounds cheese loggy.
Well,
pecans, right?
Yeah, pecans. And what might you be pairing with that today, Mr. Red Hook Winery?
Well, so it's like 95, 94, right?
Exactly.
It was a good time. We'd have to probably pair it with the White Zinfandel. It goes so well. Residual sugar.
Clinton is in office. There's definitely a White Zin happening.
Absolutely. Bold, bold pairing right there. So in the number two position, we're really moving on to one of my favorite cheeses. If I could name one cheese that I was just mowing in the 90s, it was Munster. Grocery store Munster. And I'm not talking about Alsatian Munster. I'm talking about Wisconsin Cheese Factory Munster. Bouncy, plasticky, tacky, white, completely smooth and uniform in texture, with a nice annatto facade. Yes. What does that mean? Bright orange annatto on the outside, you know? And what we're really seeing here is America's very vague awareness of the fact that cheese was something other than Velveeta and block cheddar. We were going for a washed rind cheese from Alsace, but we didn't hit the mark.
Yeah. To quote a relative of mine when referring to the Rhine, can you eat the wax? That's not wax.
That's
okay. Well, can you eat it? Sure.
If it ain't plastic wax,
we had a lot of Munster down. I'm from Kentucky, and there was a lot of grocery store Munster happening in 1994 in my house.
Oh yeah,
thank you for that.
My pleasure. What do you want? What are we going to drink with that?
Wait. So my quick question: so the orange on the Havarti is—it's really the
it's annatto. It's a seed.
Yeah. Annatto. Yeah, it's a plant. It's a plant-based dye that comes from. And the annatto seed.
To sell more, because in the 90s, that orange flavor color is really what you're looking for.
Yeah, with this particular cheese, they were, you know, vaguely trying to mimic a classic washed rind cheese from Alsace.
Gotcha.
And they didn't understand what was actually happening with that cheese. They didn't understand that it was a cheese that was being washed and cared for and had a rind that was cultured and developed over time, and that the color of the rind was a reflection of the different yeasts and bacteria that had populated the outside of it.
Just dye it.
Yeah, just dye it. I mean, come on.
Just shellac it and spray it, baby. Exactly. Wrap it up and sell it.
If it looks good, it tastes good.
That's right. America.
And that cheese was pretty low acid, right?
Very low acid.
So you want something like high acid, like a Boone's Farm kind of thing.
I was just, that's exactly
the sparkle
was.
Gives you the illusion
strawberry
of high acid.
Ooh, yeah. And yes. You want strawberries and cheese. It's just exactly. Like incredible together.
The first time I ever got Boone's drunk Farm. Was on a six-pack of mini Boone's Farms.
Oh, nice.
Man, those exist.
Oh, they exist. I'm going to get you some.
90s, I've only seen a large bottle.
We're going to enjoy some together.
All right. Oh, Bottles and James. Maybe I'm thinking Bottles and James.
That was I think both are just perfect pairings. What's our number three cheese?
Well, the number three cheese is really something that didn't originate in the 90s, but just something that to me is very iconic of the 90s, and that is nacho cheese sauce. Because honestly, when else do we get to eat bright neon orange food products?
Warm.
Warm. Warm.
Spreadable.
Spreadable.
The little pieces of fake Uzi. Jalapeno
yeah,
in
yeah,
it.
Exactly. Ooh, yeah, add a little spice. I'm going to have to pair this with a Pepsi.
I'm going to pair it with a tab.
A tab. I mean, come on,
a tab with a swirly straw.
With me, right?
Maybe to bring it full circle, if you can kind of counterpoint it with like a real classy thing, like a real super buttery oaky Chardonnay.
Ooh.
Which would be
the cream plus the cream.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Exactly.
My mouth is watering.
Or a Mountain Dew Code Red. I feel like either would be complimentary. Nice.
Wait, I don't know if they had that in the 90s.
I don't think so either. Was that not until the early aughts? Clear Pepsi maybe could have.
This is when you know you're getting older, when you start to lose focus. I was like, that was in 1992, right? And then someone's like, no, that was last year.
And they were 64 remember. Ounces then. They weren't these like 2-liter things.
Yeah.
The mayor is your friend.
Well, yeah. God
exactly.
knows. You know,
thank you, mayor.
No big gulps.
Yeah, exactly.
No big gulps.
Cheese number four.
Cheese number four. No cheese board would be complete without a sheep's milk cheese. And Manchego was, you know, probably one of the first mainstream sheep's milk cheeses that we had in this country. And it was really, you know, paved the way for a lot of other, you know, nicer, finer cheeses to come in. But in this case, there's always been a lot of confusion as to how the word is pronounced, what the word actually is. So the fourth cheese on our plate today is actually Manchego, but it's going by the name of Manchango.
Manchango.
Yeah, Manchango, which is pretty much the way I would say.
I worked in a Spanish restaurant for 3 years, and everyone ordered Manchango.
And the server at Chardonnay's is going to correct you and say, "So you want the Manchango?
Manchango.
Because they took a wine class. All right. They took a wine and cheese class, and they know.
Exactly.
Do we have a fifth cheese?
Well, the fifth cheese, you can't end a cheese board really without a blue. And in this case, we're just going to shake some blue cheese crumbles out onto the plate. We might toss a few cranberries and chopped almonds.
Yeah, it's like the same stuff you put on the salad. Mm-hmm. You also put it on the plate.
Exactly. Bold, brash, metallic, harsh. You know, just a really, really very much a punch in the mouth to finish it off.
And you can just sort of shake that onto a piece of brioche toast.
Or just shake it right into your mouth.
I'm actually getting hungry.
This has been a great show, and I'm really glad we got to end on such a fun note. Frank Winters, let us know where we can get information about your show.
Yeah, tell us about your company, because you guys are doing consistently cool stuff that people should know about.
Oh, yeah. If you are interested in any of the things that I said, and for the record out there, if you do run into the people who work at Indie Food and Wine, don't repeat anything that I said, because there could be legal implications. But if you're interested in puppets or plays, and you know you want to see it by people who aren't getting paid for it, you can go to www.strangemancompany.com. It's the name of the theater company I'm a part of, and you know, we're always doing something fun or irreverent for the kids, you know.
To wrap this up quickly, Frank's being self-deprecating because that's his way. But they're doing incredibly effective work and stuff that's pretty charged politically and socially and is very important. And he won't say that, so I will. So thank you for coming on.
At the microphone sometimes.
It's okay. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm learning so much. Welcome. Can I ask, by the way, what is, if it's not wax, what is it? I don't know anything about cheese.
Oh, the wax is oftentimes put on the outside so it of
is,
cheeses.
It is wax.
I was joking because we were talking about what is not wax.
Oh, I felt bad. I don't know what's wax and what's
okay.
Not. That's
okay. A lot
scared.
Of people don't. It's and that's an interesting when you're. I think a lot of small town America. Unfortunately, that's part of food culture. Yes, I am from small town America as well. But that's one part of food culture that people I think are very intimidated by is cheese.
Absolutely.
Cheese and wine are the two things. I know I have a lot of relatives in Kentucky. They just can't talk about it. But anyway, we're going to save that for another time. Thank you all for coming. And again, to reiterate, there are still volunteer initiatives happening in many of the affected neighborhoods. And Red Hook Initiative is the one that we were talking about yesterday.
Yes.
So if you're interested, for those of you listening today, check that out. Give it a Google.
Redhookwinery.com.
Redhookwinery.com. Not only because they're friends of ours in need, but because they make a fantastic product. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Happy to say it. And Ms. Chebek, thank you for talking to us about cheese.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
And I'm glad Murray's is safe and up and running. And my heart goes out to any restaurants that have been incredibly devastated and are not up and running yet. And
yeah, our hearts to yours. Honestly, everybody, this is a close-knit industry, and our thoughts and prayers are with you. And for those of you who are downtown and around the Village area in Tribeca, again, eat down tip up. I think it's eat down tip up.
Eat down tip up.
Eat down tip up.
Dine down might be better.
Dine down tip up.
Pretty sure it's eat down. I'm pretty sure, regardless. I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
On that note, this is
it's Anthony Bourdain. It's
Heritage.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.